From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin. It's Sunday, February 7th, Super Sunday, and this is our weekly look into the politics that shape our lives. Time to grab that Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get things going off to a good start for your week. Yep, Super Bowl Sunday, and of course, no Bears. Well, it should be a great game, though. And this could be, you know, Peyton Manning maybe playing his last game for Denver. You got the great defense of the Carolina Panthers. And the trouble is, Dave, I've been working so much.
Haven't had a chance to follow anything.
I'm not sure I'll be awake when this game starts, you know, especially because the pregame is already started, actually.
The pregame starts the week before.
Yeah, exactly.
Anymore with the Super Bowl.
But it's good to have you back, Dave, after the road trip.
Thanks.
And thanks for getting the oil changed in the Zamboni while you were down there in Florida.
Oil change, new suspension, new plugs and points, the whole bit. Yeah.
While you were gone, and Susan Berkus was here, and I was explaining to her and our listeners that the weather was so nice last weekend. I mean, and actually, it's nice this weekend, but it was so nice last weekend. We were going to take up a collection to keep you in Florida, figuring that was kind of an omen. You know,
I would gladly have accepted. I would gladly have accepted the contributions.
Well, you sent me plenty of pictures, and it looks like you had a great time.
It was a wonderful week and a half, even though I was telling you earlier, and Steve and a couple other people, that the first few days, colder than normal temperatures, and a lot of rain around Fort Myers and Tampa there. They had 13 inches of rain in that part of the state last month.
Jeez.
So not a lot of outdoor activity there, unfortunately. However, we spent some time with some great friends. Again, had a wonderful visit with Lyle Dean a week ago.
Oh,
it was great to see him. He's doing just great.
That's wonderful.
And some other family friends, Key West, of course, and the Kennedy Space Center. I will tell me to shut up, but I'll tell you, it is just an overwhelming experience to go there. We had hoped to see a satellite launch on Wednesday, but that had been postponed for, we found out, the second or third time, and apparently went off on Friday. That's just one of those things. But nonetheless, just an amazing 2 days at that space center. Just incredible.
You know, it's been a long time since I've been down there. But, I mean, there's a lot of interactive things at the space center.
You bet there are. And kids who, you know, maybe as young as 5 and 6 years old, who have absolutely no memory of what we grew up with you know, the moon shots and early space shuttles and so forth. You know, they were just having a great time checking out all the interactive things, climbing into the space capsules to see how small they were.
Oh,
and
yes.
Believe you me, it's just unbelievable, how people spent time, week, maybe up to 2 weeks sometimes in those early space capsules, as they called them, let alone the fact that they're not even on Earth. They're 250,000 miles away. In rooms that are the size of phone booths.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at those early Mercury space capsules, I mean, it's basically almost like a custom-fitted seat, and then that's it.
To use the words of one astronaut, we were shoehorned in. And they were. They were shoehorned in, yes.
Well, of course, in the Gemini, that's when they're the spacewalk. So at least they did get a chance.
They did get a chance to get out and stretch their legs,
to limber up a little bit.
I'm sure you've heard the old joke now about why women were begun to be included in space shuttle flights. You know why they actually did that?
No, why?
Not only because they were very accomplished scientists, but they would insist on people stopping to ask for directions with the other people on board.
Okay, that'll get the phone lines going here this morning. But Key West is absolutely gorgeous. And
sunny in 78 when we were there. It's a world all by itself. It really is.
You want to explain that a little bit?
Well, it's just a big party, especially along Duval Street, the main street there. If you've been to New Orleans, you've been to the French Quarter, you've been to Bourbon Street, you know what I'm talking about. It's just one place after another, everybody having a great time, but no one getting out of line. You know, we didn't feel unsafe or threatened. You know, there were some, you know, people that were maybe dressed a little wacky, but other than that, it was a very, very fun place to be. A lot of a fun atmosphere. And again, it's got to be the weather down there.
Just going to say, you have to imagine that with the weather like that, you know, that's you just kind of are in this paradise.
Yeah. Well, that's right. They call it that for a reason. And the other thing that's interesting is that I don't know why this is, but there are roosters running all over the place. Roosters.
Roosters.
Yes. They're I don't know where they came from or who brought them there, but there's a restaurant. You would like this place, Rick, called Blue Heaven.
Blue Heaven.
Blue
okay.
Heaven. We had breakfast there on the recommendation of a good friend. And there are roosters and cats running all over the place, just within the...
Through
within
the restaurant?
Through the outside. Well, it's outside.
Uh-huh. Oh.
But, yeah, through the restaurant. And they advertise proudly, have breakfast with the roosters, which we did. Food was great. But, yeah, they'll just come right alongside, and nobody bothers them.
Does the place serve chicken? I was just wondering if that's kind of a pick your own, you know.
I don't know if they do or not. I did not see coq au vin on the menu.
Yeah, that was my first thought. Yes,
it was just a tremendous place to go, and visitors and locals alike just to mingle and get along just great.
Well, I'm glad you had a great time and much deserved time away from Tribune Tower and. Good to have you back, and you know, just in time to take in all of the politics that's going on.
Not only that, but the forecast later in the week tells us that winter is not over.
Yeah, I know. I saw that it looks like we're going to be going into the 20s.
Yes.
On Wednesday.
Yes, Wednesday. In fact, the high will be lucky to get up to 20 on Wednesday. Snow showers. You know, off and on, that we'll see some snow, maybe a half inch or so accumulation overnight. But yeah, later in the week, Wednesday, Thursday, a high only around 20, maybe a low Thursday night of 13.
Wonderful.
I said, winter is not over.
Well, welcome back, Dave. See what you brought?
I think I'll...
Is it too late for to take up that collection, maybe?
No, it's not. I repeat, it is not.
Well, welcome back. Dave's here. He'll keep us up to date on all the news, traffic, and weather. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls, and you can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is trying to figure out if he'll take the over or under in today's football game. Just a reminder, as always, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. And you can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching Rick Pearson. Well, coming up, we've got a great show today after the 7:30 news. Michael Golden joins the show, and Michael's the author of Unlock Congress, Reform the Rules, Restore the System. We'll be talking about the current state of the presidential race, New Hampshire, money, and politics. And then after the 8 o'clock news, we're going to spend a full hour with the roundtable to review the results about the Iowa caucuses and take a look ahead at New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary on Tuesday. Right now, though, it's time for a break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics and, of course, the Iowa caucuses officially kicking off the presidential sweepstakes. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton eking out a slim victory over Bernie Sanders. On the Republican side, Ted Cruz cruising to a win over Donald Trump and Marco Rubio, but there always seems to be some sort of controversy. Trump accused Cruz of dirty tricks, his aides telling some caucus-goers that Dr. Ben Carson had dropped out of the race, though he hadn't. And then Cruz also sending a controversial mailer that looked official and gave voters bad grades to try to get them to show up at the polls. In Milford, New Hampshire, here's Donald Trump.
All of a sudden, I see an ad or something. Donald Trump is in favor of Obamacare. And people are calling, oh, I thought you were against it. That's too bad. These are dishonest people, these politicians. These are worse than real estate people in New York, I'm telling you. No, these are truly dishonest people. Then he said, Ben Carson has quit the race. The day of the election. Ben Carson, during a caucus, Ben Carson has quit the race. And Ben didn't quit the race. In other words, Ben Carson quit and let me have your votes. What kind of crap is this? And then he makes up a thing that says, like it's on a government document, voter violation. It says on top, just like it comes right out of government, municipal, voter violation. And it talks about, it gives grades, F, 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 you haven't voted. But it says you can go vote, but you got to go vote for him. And people are afraid. They think, oh, I'm in violation. I have to go vote. What kind of people are these people? And then the attorney general in Iowa is investigating, but by that time, they're all gone. The election's over. What kind of people do we have running for office? No, it's honestly really, really dishonest. And I think I know why. You know why? Because he was born in Canada. Was. Happens to be a problem, folks. That happens to me. You watch. The Democrats, they've already said they're going to sue him. He gets the nomination, they're going to sue his ass off.
That's Donald Trump. Now, for his part, Dr. Ben Carson says that the Cruz strategy definitely hurt his turnout at the caucuses.
I was getting a lot of intelligence from a lot of different places saying that I was going to do extraordinarily well. And I do think it affected that. There was one instance where my wife went to a caucus, and my representative had already spoken, but a Cruz representative had spoken and told people that I was, in fact, not going to be continuing. And the people wanted to actually hear from my wife. So she was an unscheduled speaker, and she obviously disabused them of that notion. And they were extraordinarily happy, I must say, gave her a standing ovation, and I won that precinct. Who's to say what the outcome? I don't think we can say what the outcome is, but we can say whether or not we take something like this and just sweep it under the rug and say, it's just the way it is, or are there consequences?
Well, Cruz apologized to Carson about those issues and did so in last night's Republican debate. And Cruz said he wasn't personally aware of what happened in some of those caucuses. But as for Donald Trump, the Texas senator isn't apologizing.
Well, listen, it is no surprise that Donald is throwing yet another temper tantrum, or if you like, yet another Trumper tantrum. It seems his reaction to everything is to throw a fit, to engage in insults. And I understand that Donald finds it very hard to lose, that he finds that very difficult for him. But at the end of the day, the Iowa people spoke. Donald Trump guaranteed a victory in Iowa, and then he lost. And he doesn't like that. And his reaction is that he breaks down. He really has problems. You know, he accused the people of Iowa of being stupid. In fact, he skipped the Iowa debate. It makes you wonder if his next step is to accuse the people of New Hampshire of being stupid, if he plans to skip the New Hampshire debate, and after that, if he plans to accuse the people of South Carolina of being stupid and skip the South Carolina debate.
Now, as for the controversy over Cruz, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says, I was done, and now the focus should be on New Hampshire. Here's Chris Christie speaking to Fox News.
I don't think it ever helps after you lose an election to ask for a do-over. And so the fact is, elections are played. They're not bean bagged. They're not easy. I've been through a lot of them. I've been through a number of them where they're very rough and tumble. What you do is you move on to the next one and you forget the last one. And so I don't think this is something that we should be wasting our time talking about when New Hampshire is 5 days away.
Now, also on the GOP side, Jeb Bush is looking to New Hampshire to try to rescue his presidential campaign. His mother was out on the campaign trail, and his brother, former President George W. Bush, he's done an ad for Jeb Bush's super PAC.
The first job of the president is to protect America. Our next president must be prepared to lead. I know Jeb. I know his good heart and his strong backbone. Jeb will unite our country. He knows how to bring the world together against terror. And he knows when tough measures must be taken. Experience and judgment count in the Oval Office. Jeb Bush is a leader who will keep our country safe.
That's President George W. Bush in an ad for his brother. But problems are plaguing the Bush campaign, and perhaps there was one incident last week at a town hall that he hosted in Hanover, New Hampshire, that kind of sums up the Jeb Bush campaign so far. I want you to listen closely to this.
Here's my pledge to you. I will be a commander-in-chief that will have the back of the military. I won't trash talk. I won't be a divider-in-chief or an agitator-in-chief. I won't be out there blowharding, talking a big game without backing it up. I think the next president needs to be a lot quieter, but send a signal that we're prepared to act in the national security interests of this country to get back in the business of creating a more peaceful world. Please clap.
Please clap. When a candidate has to bring their own applause sign to an event, you kind of know that there's a little bit of trouble around. Well, Ohio Governor John Kasich is looking for a big finish in New Hampshire. Polls showing him with some momentum there. Kasich and Marco Rubio have quickly become kind of establishment favorites on the Republican side. And in an interview with CNN, Kasich talked about what was his favorite concert growing up and how would music shape his presidency? Here's Ohio Governor John Kasich.
Pink Floyd's The Wall. Roger Waters is, you know, a remarkable artist. And I saw The Wall in Pittsburgh. It was absolutely incredible. I don't even have to think twice. It was the best. And if I'm president, I am going to once and for all try to reunite Pink Floyd to come together and play a couple songs. And since we have so much trouble in America with our finances, I'm going to start with a little song they created called Money.
And thanks to John Kasich, that gives me a great excuse to play something that I've always wanted to do on the radio. One of my all-time favorite groups, Pink Floyd. Here's a little bit of that song called Money. A little bit of Pink Floyd to get the Sunday morning started. Nothing better than that. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. We've got a great show for you today. Up ahead is my friend Michael Golden. He's author of Unlock Congress, and we're going to be talking about money, politics, redistricting, New Hampshire, the presidential race, all of those good things. And then after 8 o'clock, David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University, will be part of our roundtable with Matt Strawn, former Iowa Republican chairman and founding principal of Next Generation Public Affairs, as well as Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University in Des Moines.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, just out on the WGN Storm Center patio where the weather is starting to warm up a little bit. It's supposed to get up into the 40s today, which you can't complain about that on this February 7th. Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my friend Michael Golden. Michael is the author of Unlock Congress, He also teaches at Benedictine University, and you just got a new position too at Arizona State.
Arizona State in the spring, and then back in the summer at Benedictine with Phil Hardy and Tammy Sarver. Great people, a great department, and I've spoken at the Civic Leadership Center out there. Just a wonderful program at Benedictine, so I'm really excited about it. And thanks for having me today, Rick.
Well,
I love coming in here.
And we've talked about the book before, and we haven't been on before, and now it's being used as curricula at Ohio State, ASU, Arizona State, UIC, Elmhurst College, Benedictine. That's fantastic.
You know Dick Simpson for a long
right.
time, and he's using it in an American government class, and then I'm coming in early April to talk to a class of 160 students. So that's really exciting. You know, he's one of our political deans in terms of academia in Chicago. So I'm really grateful to Dick. So many people, especially in the Chicago community where we're from, have been really great.
Well, and you note the book is Unlock Congress, but still there are issues in Congress that actually you see it surface in the presidential campaigns. And I know, number one, the whole issue of money, I mean, is unbelievable. And when you look at the money that is being poured in by particularly the candidate super PACs, it's just unbelievable. And we'll have David Yepsen on later, but he's just back from Iowa, but just the nonstop incessant advertising that's all part of the modern day presidential campaign.
Yeah. And David knows this all too well. And so do you. We watched it for years. And I write about it a lot in the book on the congressional level, but in the presidential race, at least a couple months ago, the figures were that super PAC money coming in, half of the money that was going into the presidential race was from less than 150 families in the United States of America, which is it's almost the definition of oligarchy.
The New York Times, I think, was doing a series on these political families.
I'll tell you, but the good thing is, and I think it's different in congressional races because so many candidates have no name ID and they don't get national, obviously, as much airtime as these presidential candidates are. But I would say there's one good thing this election cycle when it comes to the money in the presidential race, and that is that a couple of these candidates have really maneuvered their way to the top of the polls without spending a fortune. And the most stark example of the reverse of that is obviously Jeb Bush, who spent the most and, to many people, shockingly, has done so poorly. And I wrote an article in a column in Roll Call a couple of weeks ago about, and you know this better than anybody, the value of being good on television, not just the ads, but in the presidential race, you better seem confident and think on your feet. And we had an example of that hurting Marco Rubio last night. He fell into a trap that was set for him, and then he fell further into it. Television's so powerful.
Well, the whole issue with Rubio, where Chris Christie had said he was going to come at him at some point,
right,
basically just blasted him on, lack of experience, that kind of thing. And then to see Rubio come back with just kind of his rote answers repeatedly.
Yeah, three times.
And I did like Chris Christie's crack about kind of the drive-by Washington,
right,
25-second soundbite answer. And Rubio looked like a deer in the headlights.
I was actually shocked because not at the criticism, but Rubio did this twice. In fact, the third time, Christie cut him off and said, "There you go, folks. There's his stock line." I'm paraphrasing.
Right.
I mean, he just it was a little bit embarrassing. That's one of those things where presidential primaries, we say it's this grueling job interview, and it really is, because eventually you get down to the core of who these guys are. That was Marco Rubio's chance to think on his feet and push right back, and he fell right into that trap. I actually think his nerves got the better of him.
Well, and he did look visibly
shaken.
yes. And what's surprising to me is, obviously, one, the lack of prep, knowing that something like this was going to be coming, particularly after his finish in Iowa, where, Iowa, he's the rising star and basically tries to paint third place as a victory and taking a victory lap. And I think he was too busy still trying to take this victory lap without focusing on what's ahead. And I have to wonder how much at this stage of the game, and, you know, New Hampshire voters are traditionally
late breakers.
And whether this so close to Tuesday's primary, what effect that may have on a guy, as I said, who was kind of viewed as somebody who was rising.
It's a fascinating dynamic. Setting aside even Trump for a moment, these governors got to be just pulling their hair out because, they do take chief executive service seriously, and it is a different experience. The problem is that there were four or five of them in the beginning, and one hasn't been able to break through. That's the irony, is that you've got this big mouth, Trump, and then you've got two senators in second and third, and traditionally we elect governors in this country, and you have a few of them, whether you are right, left, or center. You can't argue that Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, and John Kasich aren't very experienced governors, both reelected in their states. You know, they have varying records and so forth, but they're fighting with each other for that lane, and I'm sure in private it's driving them nuts.
Oh, yeah, and but although I am curious, and there, in the polling that we've seen in New Hampshire, there seems to be some movement for John Kasich.
Absolutely,
and I'm not sure what that reflects. If that's people looking for that establishment experience lane, I guess.
You know, I think that there's a couple things about John Kasich. I have to say, and I could end up obviously being wrong. I have been about Trump. But 6 months ago,
Everybody's been wrong about Trump.
Yeah, that's true. 8 months ago, right, even before Kasich announced, but you knew he was going to, I really thought that he had a good shot of being the dark horse in this race and surprising people because, first of all, on paper, he beats them all. He was chair of the finance committee in Congress, so he has that talking point, and that's his record.
Right.
He was the quote architect of those balanced budgets with Bill Clinton and divided government back then. I think he was on the Armed Services Committee, but he also then he was a congressman and then elected twice in the biggest state there is for the Republicans in a presidential race. Reelected by overwhelming numbers, and on paper there, he turned that budget around. Now, Ohio had a couple of good things happen to their economy, and he's taking credit for that. But still on paper, and he's a governor in a swing state, he's a reasonable, rational guy most of the time. And he had his own television show on Fox, so it's not like he's a stranger to the art of being on television. And he's really, like Christie, staked everything on New Hampshire. And also, I think the difference is, he's been really disciplined the last couple of months about being the positive guy, and you saw it last night, where he was annoyed a couple of months ago in those debates, and you could tell, he got a little irritated. He would not take the bait, and he doesn't with reporters either, in hammering the other candidates. And if you're able to do that enough where you're that guy out of a field of whatever, seven or eight or nine remaining, that appeals to especially a lot of the independents in New Hampshire, where you can register and vote in either primary. So his numbers look good, but again, he's got the problem against going two other reasonable, governors who have a good record. Those three guys are tearing it up. But I think that Rubio may have lost some support last night.
But it also seems to me too, with Kasich, for example, is he's not been given the time that other candidates have. And I think in some of those earlier debates, part of that anger was having to try to force him trying to force himself into the conversation.
He complained about it too.
Right.
I mean, a few of them have done that in debates. I don't blame them. When I see those candidates up there and one of them isn't get asked a question for 25 minutes of the debate, I feel like they're going to explode. But that's the problem with such a crowded field. That Democratic debate this past week was one of the best debates I've ever seen on the presidential level in terms of substance, fair moderation, by the hosts. And an exchange of ideas, staking out their positions and then defending. And then they even had a spontaneous handshake before it was even over. I mean, it's getting a little testier now, but people got to learn a lot about both of them. But as you say, part of that dynamic is there's only two candidates.
Right.
There's more time.
We're speaking with Michael Golden, the author of Unlock Congress, and we're talking about the presidential race. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And joining me here in studio is Michael Golden, the author of Unlock Congress. And we're talking about the presidential race. And, you know, Michael, you mentioned the story you wrote about in Roll Call about how important television is. And you having been a former television news reporter, you know, Trump, I mean, without TV, there is no Donald Trump.
Nope.
I mean, he is the master manipulator.
Yep.
But, I mean, when you watch some of these debates, too, and in some of these forums, the moderators are obviously playing to have Trump talk.
They are. They are. I wrote a different column about that, the media's catch-22. It's a dance. And I used to be, as you know, out in California, I used to cover politics for an NBC affiliate back in the 90s and in the Central Valley, which was the swing vote capital of California. So even back then when it was Dole versus Clinton, you know, and Kemp, and these guys would come through. But now with all the digital channels and the, you know, minute-to-minute video that's uploaded to the web, it's not even television, it's video, right? It's being on camera. It's more important than ever. And the networks, you know, I got pretty highfalutin in that column a couple weeks ago about the media's catch-22 with Trump. They all cover him live in these events for half an hour at a time. They don't cover Sanders half an hour at a time. Matt Bai said on Meet the Press about a month ago, in front of his journals and brethren and the nation at 9 a.m. on a, you know, Sunday morning, he said, I think we've done a huge disservice to the American public by pumping up Donald Trump for months. We've been complicit in where he is. And he wasn't saying it against Trump per se. He's just saying, if we give any candidate that's this entertaining this much airtime and not the other candidates, that's not what journalism is about. That's what, if you were programming primetime entertainment, The Apprentice or The Celebrity, you know, that's what that's about. But the problem is, these are all companies. These are not nonprofit entities. They have to get eyeballs to drive ratings. It's not that complicated. And I fought against that even when I was a local news reporter. It bothered me then. It's one of the reasons I left. And it's a tough one, right? Because if they don't take Trump live, everybody who wants to see the goofy show clicks over to the other national cable network that's carrying him. It's a really dicey thing, and I think a lot of those broadcasters and journalists know it, but they don't want to become irrelevant. It's a catch-22. And my point is that let's just do better. In fact, I urged when he skipped that debate and did his veterans stunt. I mean, he could write a check for $6 million. He doesn't need to do this manipulative stunt when he's too scared to come to a debate. I thought all the networks should agree to not cover him. Cover the debate, cover other things, make a stand that we're not going to get sucked into this because it's not news. What it is someone using us to sensationalize something for their political benefit.
It becomes the media's enablers.
Absolutely. Now, there's a lot of people who disagree and say, well, it is news. Just by virtue of, he may be, you know, a coward for not going to the debate, but that's news. Okay, fine. But you know, what you're doing is you're playing right into his hand.
Well, as someone who was supposed to appear on a national cable news show and was basically preempted because they were taking Donald Trump live, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, I mean, it is a catch-22, but at the same time, you kind of, as you say, there should be doing better. Then you should be taking a half hour of each one of these candidates then, or 10 minutes or something to try to, you know, play fair.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you saw this, but I think a week or two ago there was an article in Politico about how Donald Trump, that this was not some rash decision to run for president, that he had been planning this for 3 or 4 years, and that he was very studied about the media. I think that Morton Downey Jr. actually rented from him many years ago. Remember when he was all the rage for less than 2 years on television, and he started all this huge arguing live and making it, you know, this sort of circus in live television. And Donald Trump knew what he was doing. A lot of the things he says, I think, are off the cuff, and he goes by instinct, but he knew darn well that once he started and got them hooked, on a completely different campaign where he was saying what he thought and just didn't care because he doesn't have to raise money, that they would follow him. I don't think he had any idea that it would be this, he'd get this kind of coverage. But this was strategically decided by him a while ago. In fact, I think that's why that whole birther thing with Obama started a few years ago. He was testing the waters to see just how much attention can I get playing on people's either anger, fears, or dislike of the president, and doing it in a way that's much louder, you know, having investigators go to Hawaii and whatever he did.
Well, and of course, when we look at the polls in New Hampshire, and he's the front runner there, and it is a primary versus a caucus in Iowa, which is a whole different kind of organizational effort for the presidency versus, you know, a primary. But I still have to wonder, as strategic as Donald Trump is, about in the end, it's all about brand. And, you know, winning and losing the brand. And I mean, as a businessman, it would seem like the downside is much greater than the upside.
For him as a businessman?
Yes.
Depending on what happens with the campaign. You know, what he does, he doesn't, you know, he talks about building all the time, but it's a fact that he does a ton of licensing of his name, you know.
Sure.
So I don't know how much this would hurt him. You know, it's that old expression, any ink is good ink, or any, you know, any attention you get in PR is good attention. You know, he's an incredibly polarizing figure. Just the people in the electorate who love him, most of them keep on loving him. And he has the highest unfavorables too, right?
Right.
There's 35 to 40% in New Hampshire who said, I won't vote for Trump under any circumstances. There are some people who still don't think he's serious, that he just keeps saying crazy things because he's looking for a way out. I don't agree with that. I think he wants to be president.
Michael, very quickly, on the Democratic side,
yeah,
you look at that close race in Iowa. Yes, the debates are very informative, but you've got Bernie Sanders with a big lead in New Hampshire. And I would argue that, and we'll go into this later too, but I would argue that I don't think Hillary Clinton actually won Iowa. And I don't mean, yes, she did, but I don't view that as a victory.
No, right. And actually, so I'm so glad that this is probably our final minutes. I'm glad that you brought that up, because it ties right into the television conversation. Bernie Sanders, he may be old and hunched, older and hunched, and seem like this sort of irritated,
angry,
avuncular figure. Yeah, but he is as authentic as a guy can be who's been in politics for 30 years. And that's what all these young people like when he's on television. They like his message too, I think, a great deal, because they're worried about their future. And he is far more progressive on some of these positions than Hillary Clinton is. But she has been on television for more than 20 years, and she's just not good at it. This is an aptitude television. Some people will never get much better. You watch Bill Clinton at some of these rallies next to her, it just looks painful, because he's a natural. Barack Obama's a natural. Ronald Reagan was a natural. Even George W. Bush, who didn't come off as the most erudite political candidate, he was likable. There was something folksy and confident about him. Hillary Clinton seems scripted and calculated. She's a very smart and capable person, no matter what your politics are. But when that red light goes on, there's not a lot of warmth or authenticity there. And the irony is that, like Mitt Romney, like Al Gore, like a lot of candidates, the people that know them say that in person, and I've experienced this. I wrote a speech once for Al Gore in Missouri. And we went over it for 20 minutes before he went up on stage. He was warm, smart, engaging, curious, asked questions about all these different local facts. Then he went up on stage in front of 300 Democrats, no cameras. It was a rally just to get the troops fired up. And he didn't read a word of my speech, and he was fantastic. He was at ease. So if you see him on Letterman, whatever the talk show is now, he's great in that setting. But if he's answering political questions, just like Hillary Clinton, just like Mitt Romney, they freeze up.
And it's the authenticity factor.
It kills them.
That's Michael Golden, author of Unlock Congress. And Michael, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I appreciate you getting up.
It's always great to be here. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, our political roundtable this week with David Yepsen, the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, Matt Strawn, the former Iowa Republican chairman and founding principal at Next Generation Public Affairs, and Dennis Goldford, political science professor at Drake University in Des Moines.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Rick Pearson back for the second hour of this week's edition of Sunday Spin. And joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Dave Yepsen from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, former national political columnist for the Des Moines Register, Matt Strawn, former Iowa Republican state chairman and founding principal at Next Generation Public Affairs, and on the phone is Dennis Goldford, professor of political science, Flansburg Fellow, the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizens Engagement at Drake University. Dennis, that's a big business card.
Well, I use both sides.
Equal opportunity, as always. Thanks so much for joining me this morning. I want to go back and take a look at the results and what did Iowa tell us? And, you know, again, noting the difference of the nature of a caucus versus a primary. And one of the things I want to start out with, and maybe David first to you, Ann Seltzer is, you know, a renowned pollster and is the gold standard, I consider, for polling. And yet you saw that it was Ted Cruz that was kind of cruising into victory here, and Donald Trump finished second, and Marco Rubio's ascension to third place. Is it the nature of a caucus? Is it the nature of how polling is done, and maybe we need to get better at it?
Well, in this case, I mean, I think Iowa performed its traditional function. It elevated some candidates and it eliminated others. It elevated Marco Rubio. And it eliminated four other candidates, three Republicans and one Democrat. So that's a traditional function. The polls, you have to always be careful of using them as a predictor in doing caucuses. In this case, the Register's Iowa poll, which is very good, called Trump ahead a few days out. Turns out Cruz was ahead. Ann went back, looked at that. You look at the internals of that. And your model... her model didn't have enough evangelicals. I mean, once again, there seems to be more and more evangelicals are coming into the Republican Party. I think it was 64% of the turnout was evangelical. And I think the model was based on something like 60%. So if you adjust the data for that kind of an evangelical turnout, Cruz wins, would have won.
Dennis, I've seen it suggested too, and I think it was actually by Ted Cruz's pollster, the nature of... maybe doing the polling and coming out of the field too early, and that, you know, it's this constantly evolving kind of electorate that you can't really tap into when you get out of the field too early.
Well, you have to come out of the field at some point, but there is the danger. I like to remember, betray my age here, in 1980, everybody knew in the general election that Ronald Reagan would more than likely beat President Carter. But everybody thought it was close, and polling stopped on the Friday. What the polling did not pick up was that over that weekend, a lot of people that were undecided finally came down on the Reagan side of the fence, and that made the difference. Now, the difficulty is, with regard to the caucuses, that as Matt and David absolutely know, you can re-register as late as caucus day and caucus night. In a regular election, quite often you've got until about 10 days before the election. Some states may be still 30, I'm not sure. But you pretty much know your universe at that point. You don't quite know it until caucus night itself, and then you add in the factor that Dave mentioned with regard to perhaps not picking up the proportion of conservative evangelicals who typically participate in the Republican caucus here in Iowa.
Matt, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, I think you'd agree about Ann Seltzer is, you know, the Register poll is the gold standard. But
yeah, no question. And I think the one thing that we all underestimated was the
anti-Trump effect. We all spent a considerable amount of time pontificating that this large turnout would mean a Trump victory. And, of course, he put a very impressive vote total on the board. But I look at my precinct just north of Des Moines, a suburb about 20 minutes north of Des Moines, where we had over 100% increase in our turnout. And Trump finished a distant third. And in talking to my neighbors, my friends who were there, they were motivated to come out and vote against Donald Trump. Either, you know, some fell Rubio's way. He carried our precinct dramatically, and Cruz was a somewhat distant second. But I think that effect surprised a lot of people as well, that all these newcomers coming out just weren't the people that Donald Trump was motivating to show up.
Yeah, Rick, I just want to add one thing. Don't forget the dynamic of the caucus itself. We oftentimes think of these polls in terms of primaries and general elections. A caucus is a meeting. It's a neighborhood meeting. And what do friends and neighbors do when they get together? They talk. They talk politics. And you know, that's one of the biggest determinants of your political attitudes, is what your friends, relatives, and neighbors think. So if I go to my caucus and I think Donald Trump's pretty good, but I know Matt here knows a lot about politics, and he says, you know, Jeb Bush really would make a better president, Dave. You know, you really ought to think about voting. Well, yeah, you're right, Matt. And I'll change my mind. And that dynamic just cannot be found by any pollster whatsoever. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. Plus, all the other caveats that have to go on today about polling in any race, you know, no landlines, people don't answer phone numbers they don't recognize on their cell phone. It's a tough time for pollsters in general.
Yeah, right. And that's kind of what I'm wondering, too, is, and of course, this past week we've had a series of polls in the Chicago Tribune dealing with Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the city, and we'll actually be talking more about that in next week's show. But that whole issue of the landline, cell phones, digital era, digital polling, I mean, computer polling, that kind of, I mean, there seems to be some kind of evolution taking place, and I don't know if we know what it is yet for doing that.
I think you do have to pay attention to candidate strategy, though, at the same time. And let me blow my own horn just a little bit. I did note prior to the caucus itself that, of course, the way I put it was that, yes, the conventional wisdom suggested that if there were an increase in turnout, it would likely benefit Trump. However, the thing I noted was that Cruz's strategy, recall, was the belief that there is the pool, both in Iowa and nationwide, of a large number of conservative evangelical voters who haven't voted because there hasn't been a sufficiently conservative candidate expressing their values and beliefs. And so Cruz himself was aiming at increasing the size of the turnout. And so as we looked ahead to the caucuses, while we thought, yeah, it would help Trump, we have to be aware that this is also something Cruz was trying to do, and I think that's what occurred.
We're speaking with Dennis Goldford from Drake University, Dave Yepsen from SIU Carbondale, and Matt Strawn, former Iowa Republican chairman. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio, David Yepsen, Matt Strawn, and on the phone, Dennis Goldford from Drake University. We're recapping Iowa as well as taking a look ahead at New Hampshire. One thing I did want to ask all of you is the flap issue involving Cruz. You had the issue of Dr. Ben Carson saying that Cruz supporters were telling people at caucuses that Carson was dropping out. You had the Chicago-style mailer, I like to refer to it as, the voter violation mailer that was sent, that Cruz people sent out listed neighbors and
civic
their voting
shaming.
And their it was civic shaming and voting record and labeling it an F to kind of shame people to show up and turn out for Cruz. As far as the Carson issue, I have to wonder if that really was an issue because, as we say, caucus is different than a primary, and a caucus is a meeting. And ostensibly, you have a representative at that caucus. One, you're going to be speaking on behalf of your candidate, but two, that person is there to rebut anything like that. Matt?
Yeah, and I can speak but to one of the 1,681 precincts in the state Monday night. But we didn't see or hear anything related to the Carson Cruz flap about him potentially suspending his campaign. And you have to think about, as David mentioned earlier, the group dynamics that are in the caucus room. You know, we had the gentleman that was there representing the Carson campaign was one of the young men that was injured in that car accident that actually killed one of his volunteers. So he gave a very passionate speech, and everyone knew who he was. Everyone knew that, you know, he was affiliated with the Carson campaign. So if there were any rumors in our room, you know, he would have been there to rebut that. And from our Ted Cruz speaker, again, a neighbor got up, Iraq, Afghanistan veteran, made a passionate speech on Ted Cruz's behalf as to why he was the best one to keep America secure and safe. Not a whiff of anything related to Carson suspending his campaign. So, you know, and I guess our, you know, my one precinct focus group, certainly there was nothing said there, but the way these caucuses are designed, and this is why organization is so important, that you do have that representative there, that if there's some nonsense going on, you know, you should have somebody that can knock that down rather quickly.
Dennis, what are your thoughts?
Well, as David mentioned, and Matt knows, of course, that the caucuses are a dynamic process that evening. There is discussion. And there may be a representative from each campaign at every caucus, but there may not be. But, you know, you've got a candidate like Ted Cruz who will portray himself as this highly religious and moral man, and exceedingly polite. But, you know, below the surface, there's real hardball being played there. I think the rumor there, I think, is less significant than that really nasty mailer that went out. And that had the look at first glance, and people who are not very well informed might have feared that in some sense was a kind of legal document. And so that itself, I think, was appalling. But for all that a particular candidate or campaign, and it's not limited to Cruz, might want to portray himself as this highly religious, moral candidate, there is real hardball bordering on the nasty that occurs at times.
Let's talk about the Democratic contest, okay? And I had said on Steve Cochran's show last week that while Hillary Clinton won, I still consider it in some ways a loss, particularly coming from what we saw in Iowa in 2008, lessons learned. Michael Golden, who was on earlier, spoke about, you know, here's somebody that's been part of the public for 20 years. I still consider it a loss for her, despite she won 49.9% to 49.6%. 4 or 8 years ago, she was the inevitable candidate against Barack Obama, and Iowa set into motion the counter to that.
I think, Rick, within 48 hours, you're going to be hearing, after she loses in New Hampshire, and perhaps badly, you're going to be hearing all this, a lot more talk starting about Joe Biden again. Because Hillary Clinton...
I already am, actually.
Hillary Clinton is... it's as if she didn't learn much out of the 2008 experience and didn't recalibrate. But it's almost as if she and her people have kind of a tin ear. I mean, this notion of going off and you know, stepping out for a little $250,000 fundraiser right during a campaign. I mean, who had their head screwed on wrong and was just flawed? And so she's making too many mistakes. And plus, even before this campaign, Rick, Hillary Clinton's negatives are among the highest I've ever seen for a presidential candidate. And whether it's fair or not, that's just a political reality that she has to confront. A lot of people do not like her, and she has to overcome that with flawless campaigning. And too many times there are little glitches, there are mistakes, there's a deer in the headlights moment in a debate. And so I think what this is going to do, it really will start a lot more of this. We have to find an alternative because they're not going to Democrat. Many Democrats don't think they can elect a socialist in November, and they don't think she can get to 270 either. And the Democratic Party is starting to think, how do we get a candidate who can win about 8 battleground states and get us to 270?
Dennis, I have to agree with David. I don't see that she's learned anything from 2008.
Hillary Clinton is both a flawed candidate and a damaged candidate. And that speaks, I mean, that's not a matter of agreeing or disagreeing with the particular message she has. She's a flawed candidate in, as David said, in that she's politically tone deaf. I mean, this particular point, or when they left the White House about how they were dead broke, or when they came back for the Harkin steak fry for the first time since 2008, and she said, "I'm back," echoing the line of a crazy man in a movie from long ago. And she's not a natural politician the way Bill at least used to be. So she's a flawed candidate, and she's a damaged candidate in that whether there's anything to all the allegations about Benghazi and the emails, you don't hand your opponents ammunition to use against you. And she, in a way, has done the same thing that Bill Clinton did lots of times. It's as if they were surrounded by all sorts of enemies flicking cigarette lighters. So what do? They pour gasoline over themselves.
Well, and Matt Strawn, there was a story from CNN this past week that since 2001 until she launched her presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton and her husband Bill combined to earn more than $153 million in paid speeches.
Yeah, it's great work if you can get it. Don't underestimate the impact this has on the psyche of the Republican primary and caucus voter as well. Because they believe, when you climb inside their heads, they believe that she is so inherently flawed and this nomination is so worth having that effectively any Republican we put up against her can be successful. So these notions of, you know, national Republicans wringing their hands, we have to find the most electable nominee. In the mind of your Republican activist, Ted Cruz certainly fits that bill. You know, even Donald Trump, to some Republicans, fits that bill because they believe Hillary is that damaged of a candidate.
That's the Republican psyche.
Correct.
And you go back to that debate last night, you could see, I thought the Republicans were conducting a pretty good debate there. Rubio was rising. They were probing his weaknesses. That's the way you vet a candidate in a primary. Trump was acting much more presidential. And this is a tough, Republicans may conduct this primary in such a way that they can win a general election, that they come out of it fairly unified. And Rick, remember, this country does not award a third term to parties very often. And, you know, for Democrats to hope to get a third term, it's going to take all the pieces to fall correctly. And right now, Obama's job approval rating is not high enough to really make that a certain thing. It's going to be hard for them to replicate a third term.
We're speaking with David Yepsen, Matt Strawn, and Dennis Goldford. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Coming up on the Sunday Spin, we'll be talking about what do the Iowa caucus results, how do they affect what may happen Tuesday in New Hampshire.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We're doing a roundtable reviewing the results of the Iowa caucuses and how they affect the vote going into the nation's first primary in New Hampshire on Tuesday. We've got David Yepsen from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, Matt Strawn, former Iowa Republican chairman, and Dennis Goldford, political science professor at Drake University. And gentlemen, let's just take it right there. Actually, first, I want to get back to, we had talked about Hillary Clinton before the news break, and we've got a call from Joy. Joy, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for your time. Earlier, you mentioned when Hillary comes up, emails come up, Benghazi comes up, and those are important. But Hillary has this platform of being pro-women and all about helping women and women achieve. All you have to do is think of the name Monica Lewinsky. She was a young woman. She wasn't in a position of authority like Bill Clinton was. And although it wasn't Hillary that did the things that went on with Monica, she didn't stand up for her. She was a woman who was taken advantage of. She seemed to care about this man, love him, was maybe very, you know, misguided and stuff on that. And she made her own mistakes. But Monica Lewinsky became this big joke on late-night TV. Every time you hear her name mentioned, it goes towards basically being a slut or whatever.
Okay, Joy. No, and thank you for the call, and I understand. And in fact, during some of Hillary Clinton's appearances, this kind of issue does work itself. And, you know, I'm just not sure how offsetting a factor it may be when it does come to the women's vote. I mean, your thoughts?
Yeah, listen, I think this is just baked into the Hillary cake over the 20-plus years of being in the public eye. And when she said in the debate the other night that she wasn't part of the political establishment, I almost spit my drink out. So it's just one of many factors that, I think your average American, I'm not sure they're ultimately going to want to go back to those days.
That's exactly right. So let's look ahead to Tuesday. I mean, Iowa does what Iowa does. It does its winnowing process. It reduces the field, not necessarily picks winners, but basically puts the focus and on what was an overtly large field. But does the Iowa results have any bearing on what happens in New Hampshire, Matt?
Well, certainly. And I think we saw that the results of the Marco Rubio surge, the third place surge, if you will, all the fire was trained on him last night in the debate. Clearly, Iowa matters in that regard. I think Iowa matters when it comes to how Donald Trump has to win in New Hampshire, someone who has predicated his entire campaign on being a success and being a winner. So it's really raised the stakes for Donald Trump as well.
Dennis, I'm kind of wondering, too, about the fact, yes, we saw in the debate last night that everybody was kind of trained on Rubio. Rubio did not handle things very well. And kind of the nature of New Hampshire being voters making up their minds late, whether even last night, will have a significant impact on people and how they view Marco Rubio.
Well, he obviously did not come off looking good at all. And those of us who've watched this, certainly in Iowa, for the past over a year, noticed that Rubio does simply repeat the talking points or the statements, even the phrases he uses on the stump or in his campaign ads. Excuse me. So there's not a lot of extemporaneous thought there or speech. But the big question was we can't assume because the polls are telling us in New Hampshire that Trump's ahead. We'll see if he holds that. The question would be who comes in second in that regard. And the big fight really on the Republican side, I think, at this point is who emerges as the non-Trump, non-Cruz candidate, sometimes called the establishment alternative. And that's the claim that Rubio's wanted to make, but we had the revenge of the governors last night. We saw Bush and we saw Kasich and we saw Christie come in full bore and show that Rubio may be less than he appears. I would note simply, though, with regard to Iowa, as Matt said, Iowa matters, but just consider where we were long ago. Iowa has knocked out Scott Walker, Rick Perry, Bobby Jindal, Lindsey Graham. Now it's knocked out Rand Paul, Mike Huckabee, and Rick Santorum. So as Dave noted earlier, it's the typical winnowing function. Whether that should be the case with the state of Iowa is another issue, but Iowa's done what Iowa normally does.
And New Hampshire will do some of that more. And eventually, Super Tuesday, I wonder, Rick, if there'll be enough people vetting and dropping out that you're going to have a situation where the Illinois primary is going to actually mean something this time.
Well, and we've certainly been looking at that at the Tribune with March 15th. And, yeah, I mean, given the large number of entrants on the Republican side,
mm-hmm.
and, yes, there is the winnowing process, but nevertheless, with the fact of sustainability, and that's frankly, I think, is the next issue that will force the shoe to fall, is the financial sustainability of certain candidates.
Super PACs have not meant that much so far. I mean, they wallpapered the TVs out in Iowa, so none of that stuff was punching through. I think the only good ad was the one Bernie Sanders had. But is this a point where the super PACs do start to kick in? In other words, New Hampshire will vet some candidates out of this race. Then the race turns south, South Carolina, the SEC primary, and we maybe will get rid of a few more. But then this race comes back north in March 15th, and that's where I think Illinois could have some impact, and maybe the super PACs start having some more impact on this race, where you're in these big media states.
Well, and I believe on March 15th, too, there's a couple of factors. One, with Illinois and March 15th, that starts a process on the Republican side where it's not delegates awarded proportionally. So you're going to start seeing some influence of winner take all. Now, that's not the case in Illinois. And in Illinois, it's a kind of you have your beauty contest for president, but that's really irrelevant to the delegates because you have to go and elect delegates individually. They have who they support or in parentheses behind their name. And you have, you know, several major players that have, you know, put up full slates of delegates, three delegates per congressional district, 54 delegates. But, you know, that process, too, of March 15th, I believe Florida is that date as well. And so if you have a Marco Rubio still in the race or Jeb Bush still in the race, do you have the other candidates basically ceding Iowa or ceding Florida to one of the home state guys and making Illinois much more a competitive factor? That I don't know. But, yeah, I trust me, I think it's going to be – it could be very interesting. And now let's – and two, let's look at the – on the Democrat side. You've got Bernie Sanders in the polls in New Hampshire way out in front. So you're starting at least in 2008, Hillary Clinton, after a tearful moment, was able to win New Hampshire. And of course, that game played out for a long, long time. But she now faces the probability of yes, she won Iowa. But as I say, I don't know that that really counts. And then you go into New Hampshire – and you lose by a lot. And how does that affect her campaign?
And resources aren't going to be an issue for Sanders. As I think we repeatedly heard him say in the debate the other night, with his small donor base of an average contribution of, I believe, $27, you can go back to that well time and time again, as opposed to, you know, most of Clinton's support is coming from those folks that can stroke a $2,700 check you can only go to once.
Right, and they're maxed out.
That's right.
They're maxed out. And that is kind of that sustainability argument, is that Sanders has that potential to be able to go back. And with every donation that comes in, $27, you're building up your database.
That's a lot of Simon and Garfunkel ads.
Well, and this goes back to what we mentioned before. Where is Uncle Joe Biden? I mean, don't forget, the email controversy drip, drip, drips on Hillary Clinton. And this race goes on. And,
you know, Biden's tried this twice before. And for him to be seen as the fallback, I think, is really dangerous for the Democrats. I mean, they bet the farm on Hillary Clinton. And whether that's wise or not, we'll find out. But we're seeing again that she, again, is not the best candidate. But Biden tried in 88. Biden tried again in 2008, and I don't recall that anybody has had a serious third shot at the nomination.
And I remember 2008 so well because I think I was in a coffee house covering Joe Biden and giving a talk for 25 people that lasted 3 hours, and he answered three questions.
Once a senator, ho.
Caucus night in 2008, you know, both he and Chris Dodd were toast. I mean, that was just the end of that in 2008. So he may be seen. I mean, nobody's ever a better candidate than before he announces. And once you announce, then you come down to reality.
I love that as a bumper sticker. We'll be back with more on the Sunday Spin right after this. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We're doing our political roundtable with David Yepsen, Matt Strawn, and Dennis Goldford. Gentlemen, let's look ahead at Tuesday. I'd be curious what your thoughts are, what your predictions may be. And I want to start with the former Iowa Republican chairman. Matt, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, given how successful I was last Sunday in predicting Trump's win in the caucuses, take this with a giant grain of salt. New Hampshire is still Trump's to lose. I would still keep an eye on Ted Cruz. Obviously, they don't have the evangelical population that Iowa does in New Hampshire, but he is not only coalescing religious conservatives, but with Rand Paul out of the race, those more libertarian-leaning Republicans really have no other place to go than Ted Cruz right now. So I look for him to exceed expectations.
And kind of that independent-minded Republican voter that you find in New Hampshire. That
live free or die.
Exactly, the live free or die state. David?
I think, despite Marco Rubio's bad performance, I still think in the debate, I still think he can come out of the New Hampshire primary with something. I think John Kasich and Jeb Bush may be out of the race Kasich has said if he gets smoked in New Hampshire, you know, he's going back to Ohio.
And he's working New Hampshire.
Yeah, he's working
extremely hard. Dennis?
Well, I think I agree with Matt and Dave. I think, I would keep an eye on Cruz because he has been working the pastor circuit. in New Hampshire, which is what he did very well in Iowa. I mean, he, as much as he despises Barack Obama as a president and in terms of what Obama believes, they have been quite honest about saying we're basically copying the data mining model that the Obama people pioneered in 2008. That's what enabled Cruz, I think, to win Iowa. And if Cruz were to come in second in New Hampshire, I think that pivots him to go south very well, where he spent a lot of time, actually, before deciding to spend the last couple of months in Iowa. He spent a lot of time in those SEC states trying to create a firewall of sorts for himself. So, the other governors, it's in a way do or die, but keep an eye on Cruz.
We've got a call from John. John, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Hey, just want to close something I've been thinking about for a while. Ever since Biden bowed out, and I know you've talked about him a bit, but since he bowed out the way he did, the president right there, you know, the first lady, they were, that speech wasn't the I'm not running speech. It was written as if he was running. And then the campaign, the talk show campaign that took place afterwards, building up his favorability. And then the State of the Union speech, and gets an assignment from the president and attention at that stage. I thought ever since that time period that he's been a plant from the beginning, that they are going to let Hillary sink. They want her to go. Hillary, you want to go. That way they can say that, look, we gave her a chance, and that the whole plan is just wait until the Democratic convention and, oh, we need Biden to come out and help us out here.
Okay, John, thank you for your call. I've heard that theory being espoused before, but I can't put a whole lot of stock in it just because of the things that he cited, the kind of rollout of the very high profile announcement that I'm not going to go, Joe's not going to go, there was that kind of the initial issue before the speech about his late son on his deathbed asking him, to run for president. But I think we're too far into the game.
Yeah, I agree with that. And of course, as a former Republican chairman, I am all for him making this Willis Reed-like appearance at the convention, taking the warm-ups off and coming in to try and save the day for the Democrats and having a very messy convention. But, you also have to look at, you've got to be prepared to do what it takes to actually run. And taking him at his word, he just didn't seem to be in a place personally.
Right.
Where he could withstand the rigors of a campaign and obviously the job as president.
Rick, before we go, I want to go back to something Dennis mentioned a moment ago with evangelical voters and Cruz data mining them. One of the reasons the polls were wrong in Iowa was that they didn't factor enough evangelicals into it. I mean, just when we think we've got, 60% of the Republican electorate is evangelical, it finds out it's 64%. If Ted Cruz, through this data mining, is finding more evangelicals, particularly in New Hampshire, which we don't think of as having a lot, just imagine what he's going to be able to do when he hits the South. And even these other states, even Illinois, evangelical voters are still overcoming this notion that government is something they should stay away from. And there are still many who think it's dirty in politics, and they're here focusing on the Lord's world. And so I wonder if Dennis is right and Cruz is finding new ways to data mine more evangelicals in the Republican electorate, that could have a huge impact on the race for several more states.
Yeah, and Dennis, I agree too, because I've seen that kind of there is a path for Ted Cruz, and particularly with the influence of the South and South Carolina.
I mean, and it's ironic because, of course, Super Tuesday became a big thing because of the Democrats, because they wanted a more moderate to conservative counterbalance to a lot of the more liberal primaries and caucuses. So the Democrats are the ones initially who moved Super Tuesday who created Super Tuesday to give those southern states more of an impact. I mean, ironically now, with so many of the conservative Democrats having become Republicans, and the Republicans becoming more conservative, especially in the South, and the Democrats left in the South are more liberal, you get almost the opposite of that, with a more liberal focus in the South, although with a lot of racial and ethnic minorities on whom Hillary Clinton is counting. But I want to add one other thing with regard to the convention issue that you guys mentioned, which is, remember, we don't have the old rules anymore. Prior to 1972, only about a third of convention delegates in either party were chosen through primaries and caucuses. So favorite sons could go to the conventions having delegates in their back pocket to spend as they thought best for the party. But since 72, with all the post-Chicago convention, 68 convention changes, some people call them reforms, other people don't think they reformed much, but, you know, you've got something like 75-80% of delegates now chosen through primaries, and most of whom are bound, at least on the first ballot, to vote for the person that won the primary. Democrats do have the superdelegates not bound by anybody, and Hillary Clinton's got a huge number of those, and maybe they could shift to Joe Biden. But just in terms of the mechanics, it would be very hard to do the sort of thing, you know, bring in
the relief pitcher.
The Lone Ranger, right, the relief pitcher. Good analogy, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Republican, down the road, the Republican convention. And, of course, we do have this accelerated calendar.
Which was supposed to benefit the establishment and the well-moneyed candidates when we went to this more compressed calendar and schedule for this go-around. And that's, you know, that's been kind of the accelerant that Ted Cruz was able to use in convincing this broader coalition to come together in Iowa. He said, for the first time, you know, movement conservatives, even those libertarian-leaning Republicans, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have a candidate that has fidelity to your principles, but now for the first time has the resources to go all the way to the convention. And a compressed schedule like we have, heavy on southeastern states, really plays to his advantage.
I think those conventions are going to be tough for establishments in both parties. I mean, you've got Americans are angry. We've talked a lot about that, the insurgency nature of what's going on in the Democratic Party, and it's also in Matt's party and the Republican Party. That's going to make for some great conventions. Those insurgents are either going to be taking them over the way Goldwater did in 64, McGovern did in 72, or there's going to be a pitched battle between the establishment and the insurgents in each party. They could be actually fun events.
And we're only bound, as Dennis referenced on the Republican side, you know, Iowa, only on the first ballot are we bound to vote as the results were on Monday night. So any ballots beyond the first one, it's free will if you're a delegate. That's when the fun starts.
The establishment versus the insurgent coming to a theater near you. Gentlemen, thank you so much. David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. Matt Strawn, former Iowa Republican chairman, founding principal at Next Generation Public Affairs. And Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University. Thank you so much. We'll be back with more right after this. I want to thank my guests this morning, Michael Golden, author of Unlock Congress, Dave Yepsen, Matt Strawn, Dennis Goldford. Great conversation on a big Super Sunday. And most of all, I want to thank you all for tuning in. And now it's time for Dean Richards.
I think you were talking about the big game today. Never mind what's going to happen in San Francisco later on. The big game is
Tuesday.
In New Hampshire right now.
The big game is Tuesday.
Tuesday. A lot of interesting developments.
Yeah, and frankly, after Tuesday actually will be more interesting because that's when I think you're going to see kind of an exodus on the Republican side here.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders big in New Hampshire.
Interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. I think during these debates from now on, they ought to, like Beyonce ought to come in and like, sing a song, like a halftime.
Like a halftime show?
Like a halftime show. Bring Coldplay in the middle of...
Well, that debate last night, they could have used a halftime intermission. That debate seemed to have gone on forever last night. I mean, even for me, and I'm a political junkie, okay?
I don't know how you do it. But as you say so many times, you do it so we don't have
That's correct.
And we appreciate that. Thanks, Rick.